Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle, is here. It's Tuesday, a little bit of a schedule bump here. Labor Day happened on Monday. Congratulations to all of you who have put your backs, your labor into this country, into some unions, into everything that makes this this place great. Doyle, what's up, man? How you feeling?
I'm feeling good, man. I'm jacked for the international date, which doesn't mean a full weekend off, but it does mean a lighter schedule. So I'll actually get to watch all six games this weekend in full and enjoy some soccer.
Oh, I see. I thought you were going to say I can kind of take the weekend off, but no, it was just to better space out the matches for your own consumption habits.
That's correct.
That's true. You know, in honor of Labor Day, that is, you know, hat tip to you, my friend. Yes, we just have six games coming up on Saturday, so we'll just have one show this week, given the kind of schedule congestion that we have. Make sure to tune in to This Is MLS on YouTube, where you can catch one Matt Doyle as well. The big games coming up this weekend, Columbus Crew hosting the Seattle Sounders at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. That's, of course, on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Other big ones, I think Houston LAFC, Doyle, has to qualify here.
Rematch.
That's a rematch. Kind of a weird scheduling quirk. That is, Houston went to LA and won 2-0 this week, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. And then a big one that's a little under the radar, but maybe not, because a new designated player was added to the bankroll of the Vancouver Whitecaps today. Stuart Armstrong is in, double Scottish internationals with Ryan Gauld. That hasn't happened since like 2012, I want to say, for that Vancouver Whitecaps team. But Vancouver going to host FC Dallas, both those teams fighting for something a little different. Vancouver fighting for the 4 seed, and Dallas just fighting to get into the playoffs. On today's show, we'll run you through all the big stuff. Supporters Shield race update. Is it just flowers for Miami? We'll let you know on that one. We'll talk about the battle for the 4 seeds. We'll dive into the bubble teams, a.k.a. not real playoff teams, but we'll get to that in just a little bit and much, much more, including some juicy quotes from Tata Martino. Before we move on, El Pistolero, Luis Suarez, retires from Uruguay, Doyle. When you retire from the MLS grind, will you have a press conference?
Absolutely, I will. Absolutely, I will. And I'm assuming that Tom Bogert will break my retirement 24 hours before anybody else has the news. Weeby, of the great center forwards of the past 15 years, so it's Suarez, Benzema, Lewandowski, Sergio Aguero, Gonzalo Higuain, Edison Cavani, who, of course, Suarez's longtime partner up top for that great Uruguay team. Olivier Giroud, and I guess Edin Dzeko would be the other ones.
Yeah.
Where do you have Suarez?
Give me Suarez.
Really?
Give me Suarez. I think Lewandowski's got an argument to be on top of this one. There's something about the personality of Suarez and the way that I consume the game. I'm not a trophy counter necessarily. If I was, I think Suarez is probably going to be up there just based on the Barcelona days. I'm more of a, how do they capture my imagination? How do they make me think about the game, both in the sense of like the technical and tactical quality, but also the person and what they added to my own consumption? Like, was I excited to watch them play? Did I know what to expect when I watched them play? Would they do something completely out of their freaking minds? And Suarez, and I don't just mean like, oh, what a goal, what a moment, what a pass, what a whatever. I mean, like, did that dude bite somebody? Did that dude just troll England in the World Cup after biting somebody? Like, that's what I need.
Did he spike a goal off the line?
Yes.
In a,
exactly. Somebody who makes the game feel like, I don't know, makes it feel like one of the best novels you've ever read, you know, where you're just like, I cannot stop turning the page. Like, what is this guy going to do? He has been a combination of all those things at some of the biggest clubs in the world, and I feel like always been pretty true to himself. And so to me, he's a gift. He's one of those players that is just sort of a gift to all of us who like to watch this and like to watch it for more than just the, as I said, the technical and tactical, for the storytelling. Like, he can vacillate between this dude's a villain 100,000% to, oh my God, he's so lovable. And that's what I like. That's what I like in my protagonists. So I'm going to take Suarez. Where would you have him?
I think there's a clear top three with him, Benzema, and Lewandowski. I think the difference is that Benzema and Lewandowski had so much more success in the Champions League. Like, both those guys were the best players on teams that won the Champions League. And obviously Suarez was at best the second best player on the team that he was on that, that won the Champions League. But to your point about trophies, yeah, he won a lot at Barcelona. He also won a lot at Gremio, and he won a lot at Ajax, and he won a lot even at Liverpool. And now he's winning a lot in Miami. So it's a top three. I would probably give the edge to Lewandowski, who we'll hopefully see in MLS at some point. But it's not like Suarez doesn't have an argument. And I will say the difference between him and Benzema and Louis is that Suarez actually has a continental trophy as well. He was a huge part of that 2011 Copa America squad that won for Uruguay. He was arguably the best player on that team. And the other guys don't have that feather in their cap. Either way, just one of the greatest number nines ever to play the game, truly. And it's awesome that he's here in MLS and playing like an MVP at this point.
I completely agree. And the beauty, like I said, is that it's not a flat legacy in the sense that, like, oh, everybody loves him. Like, hey, go ask anybody who enjoys the game. Do they like Luis Suarez? Do they enjoy watching him play? Do they think he's a good person? You're going to get a real bevy of different answers for a lot of legitimate reasons. Like, a lot of legitimate reasons. And I think maybe part of this for me is that I was at the England-Uruguay game in Brazil at the World Cup in 2014, and I saw the reaction of the England fans, and I saw the England fans after. Look, my memory goes hazy on a lot of these because I've been to too many games. But Uruguay won that game, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there were just so many upset Englishmen, and that to me is a gift as well. So I enjoyed that immensely. All right, let's just jump in here. And like I said, we're combining sort of Match Day 30, Match Day 31 into one podcast. So excuse us if we bounce around and, you know, look back, but also look forward at times. As we always do, we'll start with the best thing that we saw. Doyle, what's the best thing you saw from Match Day 30? And I just want to tell everybody right now, my recollection of what happened, because I'm a man on vacation most of the time, is not going to be super sharp, but I caught as much as I could from Lake Tahoe. So we'll start with you, who has a deeper appreciation for what just went down in MLS.
Weeby, I'm not sure who had the more dominant performance, you on the beer pong table or Houston in Los Angeles against LAFC. I mean, it's unfair. You're a state college kid and you were apparently playing some private school kids.
Not private school. You know, look, we have Air Force Academy representing. You know, we have, like, you know, Sac State is up in there. Just, mm-hmm. you know, schools you wouldn't expect to compete with the University of Kansas when it comes to throwing a ping pong ball into a red solo cup. So shout out to my compadres in Tahoe. After the kids went down, we definitely did our thing on the beer pong table. And I was absolute money. My wife's dad also participating, couldn't stand up to it. Just didn't have it.
I like that you're approaching 40 and you haven't lost your edge in the most important sport of them all. Houston, over the past 3.5 months, which is 24 games, three separate competitions, LAFC had only lost to the Columbus Crew. Against Columbus, no wins, two losses, no draws, and -6 goal differential in those two games. Against all other teams, which includes teams in Liga MX and obviously USL, because they're making the US Open Cup run as well, LAFC were 19 wins, no losses, three draws, plus 45.
Oh my God.
Goal differential.
Did you just say plus 45? 19 wins, three draws?
Plus 45.
I did not realize this.
It's Miami have been so good, and obviously Columbus have been so great, that it's overshadowed just how much of a juggernaut LAFC appear to be. And Houston waltzed into that stadium and they got on the ball and they did not at any point give it back to LAFC cheaply or recklessly. And they looked like Columbus in playing right through that press and generating chances and generating set pieces and just pushing LAFC deeper and deeper, and to the point where they got frazzled. And Houston gets the first goal off a set piece and they get the second goal off a counterattack. And it was a you know, the counter, like it looked like a Denny Bawanga goal that Lawrence Anali scored. And it felt like an LAFC counterattack because LAFC, yeah, they could do the long ball over the top, but they also do the four passes at the back just to change the angle and maybe draw the defense up a little bit and then play through you. And it was that second one. And that made it 2-0. And they, like, I will grant that LAFC are probably tired. They've played a ton of games because of their League's Cup run. They had an emotional week losing to Columbus and then turning around, going on the road and beating Seattle in the Open Cup semifinals in a game that was not easy. This is not, I don't think, a full-strength LAFC team because of that and because guys like Jesus Murillo and Olivier Giroud are carrying Knox. It doesn't matter, man. Team comes into your home and blows you off the field like that. And this is what we've been hoping for from Houston, was that Ponce and Anali could change all this possession into penetration, into chances, into goals. And then unfortunately, 10 minutes after he scores the goal, which was, again, just a breathtaking goal, Lawrence Anali apparently does his ACL, and he is almost certainly, we won't see him again until next summer, which is crushing because I, like, for 75, 80 minutes, there it was, Houston pushing their way into that elite tier of potential MLS Cup contenders. And, you know, I still think they're good enough to have a puncher's chance, but Anali was the one who I think elevated it and made them explosive in a way that nobody else on this roster has been able to do.
Who's the best road team in the Western Conference this year?
Is it the Dynamo? I'm assuming
it is the Dynamo. It is the Dynamo, or it's the Vancouver Whitecaps, technically, on points per game, I believe. But Houston are right behind. And that is so bizarre to me, Doyle, because this is a team that's built their success on being dominant at home. Last year's run, a lot of it was built on being dominant at home, and they haven't quite found that yet. They've just got 4 wins out of 12 games at home so far, and they have a home heavy schedule the rest of the way that they're going to have to use. We'll talk about that more when we talk about the 4th seed, but like I'm waiting for that performance we saw in LA to happen at home more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so heartbroken for Ben Olsen, for Pat Onstad, for this entire squad, most of all for Lawrence Anali, because what Houston went out and did pretty quietly in this transfer window, I would argue, is right up there. It's certainly top 5 in the league in terms of, hey, we have needs. Did we address those needs? Did we address those needs in an ambitious way? Did we address those needs in an ambitious way that was probably unexpected for our club based on recent history? All those were big fat check marks for the Houston Dynamo. And to have it sort of come off, to have this idea in your mind that you went out and executed on, got done in the transfer window, had built the foundation of to add those pieces to, and then have Anali go down. It's one of those things. It's one of those things where you just makes your heart sink. You know, yeah, what I mean? And I think a lot of teams struggle to come back from sort of emotional blows like that. I hope that will not be the case for the Houston Dynamo. I don't expect it to be from a team coached by Ben Olsen, but it does lessen. It lowers the ceiling a little bit, yeah, right? Like there's no arguing with that. How far does it lower it? I don't know. We'll find out. I guess we'll find out on Saturday, even potentially, when Houston hosts LAFC at 8:30 p.m. Eastern at Shell Energy. But it's just one of those things. It's like, great win, but.
Yeah.
And the but is one that's going to last for a while.
It is a complete bummer because Anali has been, you know, as you said, just a wonderful summer from that front office. And part of what made it so wonderful is that Anali brings a different kind of spark with the ball than most wingers in this league. Like, he looked like a guy who we would be going into next year saying, like, you know, who's a dark horse to make best 11? Lawrence Anali. Like, he had that kind of juice when he was getting on the ball. They will miss that. One of the silver linings from this, other than just the performance, even before Anali got on, by the way, like, Houston were far superior to LAFC. But what one of the other silver linings here is that Koko Karasagia was back, got on the field for the final 20 minutes. It's his first action in about a month. Obviously, he's a huge part of everything Houston have done since Ben Olsen took over, and he'll be a huge part of their push to, like, look, they're still going to be thinking about winning an MLS Cup, and they should. I think, you know, obviously they're not in the top three in the Western Conference. To me, they feel like a top team in the Western Conference, even after this injury.
All right, best thing I saw. Shouts go to, by the way, thoughts go to Lawrence Anala. We hope that's a quick, well, first of all, we hope it's not an ACL. We haven't seen anything confirmed on that. At least I haven't, Doyle. And if it is, we hope it's a quick and efficient and painless sort of recovery for Anali. Best thing I saw, Luke Orochano, Doyle, is reminding me of Steph Curry in the sense that, like, early days Steph Curry in the NBA was just like, well, what is my range? Let's figure this out. And that range just kept extending and kept extending as he kept hitting shots and kept being efficient from previous unforeseen distances. And Luke Orochano has just decided that he's basically like an NFL kicker. He's just like, yeah, you know what? Anytime I have an opportunity to face goal and a goalkeeper is anywhere outside of his own like immediate 6-yard box, I should probably just hit this thing. Cincinnati, without Lucho, facing off against a desolate CF Montreal team, let's just say it. Jonathan Sirois is out to lunch. I don't know what he's doing. You know, a normal game against normal players in normal circumstances, it is okay for you to be kind of wandering about at the top of your 18-yard box as a goalkeeper. Luke Orochano, I have to imagine, if you're a goalkeeper playing him, you can't do it. It's a free kick. He looks up. He says, why not? Hits it. Drives it. I don't think it's as perfect as his one earlier in the season, but it's over the head of Sirois and in. We've got it measured at about 67 point something yards. What is the NFL record field goal? Do you know?
Is it about the same? About 67 yards?
66 yards.
Well, there you go.
And there's no goalkeepers in the NFL.
How much? How many open DP slots do the Bengals have? Could they maybe bring Luka in?
Yeah, good
on trial.
I'm not sure about that one. But I mean, look, it's just one of those things where it feels like, and it is, a statistical anomaly. Not only that it's Orochano twice, but if my memory serves, it's Lucho as well this year. We've never seen this before. It feels like it's like a stat breaker. Though it's just one of those things. I don't know that we'll ever see this ever again.
I mean, I think that as teams commit more to playing out of the back and making goalkeepers part of the buildup, which has, you know, been a revolution in the game in the past 15 years, but especially I think in MLS in the past 4 or 5, I think we're actually going to see more of this. I think that it's inevitable because these guys play so high off their line now, and it's not an accident that this happened against a Montreal team with Laurent Courtois, who is trying to get his goalkeeper more involved in the buildup play. Like, they explicitly wants to be a team that
I get that, but this is a free kick situation for Orochano. This is not an in possession. I'm about to be on the ball. I'm about to have to help my team. I'm about to be the 11th man, so to speak.
Lucas El Arayan did this last year against Charlotte. Remember, he caught Christian Kalina cheating off the line. Now, granted, that was, I think, about 15 yards closer. But this happened down the stretch around this time.
That was a quick turnover, if I remember correctly.
It was a free kick.
Was it?
Yeah, it was a free kick that he took quickly.
I told you, don't trust my memory.
Yeah, man. And then there was, I think there were a couple last year with Tyler Miller when Wayne Rooney was
those were
off of quick turnovers. Those weren't off of free kicks, I don't think. But I do think it's inevitable because, look, in the modern game, a lot of managers want their goalkeepers to come up and like be part of the back line in build up, and sometimes it's gonna cost them in ways like that. We saw it in the Austin game. Brad Stewart got a million touches trying to initiate sequences for Austin against the Whitecaps. Now, obviously, the Whitecaps didn't catch him out, and Brad Stuver, he has gotten caught out before. I think it was against Houston 3-4 years ago. So it's just going to be more and more part of the game. But credit to Luka for breaking the NFL record.
Steph Curry, can I interest you in some teenage Hidebe content here? Probably not. He's signed through 25, 26 option for Cincinnati. So they add another center back to the stable. Miles Robinson currently suspended for the Hell Is Real game coming up for Cincinnati after getting a yellow card against Montreal. You can go listen to my take on this on Instant Replay. I'll give you just a little hint here. If you watch the play, as many Cincinnati fans did, but apparently sort of didn't, they couldn't understand why Miles got that yellow card. We got the yellow card for turning and shoving Matias Kokro to slow down slash stop his run in a promising attack. Okay, fine. I can see why this is a yellow card. Advantage was played. I cannot abide by the theatrics from Kokoro in this situation, and he is earning a reputation, and I mean earning, because I watch all these plays for referee stuff. I mean, the embellishment on this is just ugh. It's tough, and I can see why Pat Noonan and Cincinnati were frustrated, but I can also see why Miles Robinson got a yellow card there. So my guess is he will not be available for Hell is Real, and he probably mostly has himself to blame, though I'm going to put Matias Kokoro right up there in that ranking as well. Also, best things I saw, I just want to mention them really quick. One, Tom Bogert dunking on Toluca, interest in no particular order, Kike Olivera, Diego Rossi, and Martino Heda. None of that appears to be real, or it is, or it's not really advanced in any way, but you can see that maybe League's Cup has inspired Toluca to look within, let's say, the continent to try to get their next player. So we'll see what happens with that sort of interest. But Tom is saying, hey, get out of here. None of that is real right now. And then the other one is I want to shout out Austin fans. They're TIFO on Pride Night, supporting trans folks in Texas, and I would say all over, was really inspirational and really awesome. So shout out to you, Austin supporter section. All right, let's talk Supporter Shield race. Do we say goodbye to the chasing pack, Doyle? We had billed this as the best Supporter Shield race in a decade, and with Luis Suarez and Lionel Messi leaving after Miami had dropped 5 out of 6 points at home with them both there, it seemed like that was reasonable to think that this would really tighten up, and the gap is 7, and Miami have a game in hand on the Galaxy, who are the team 7 points back, and they just beat Cincinnati, who are now 8 points back. And Columbus has games in hand, 2 of them, but even if they win both of those games, they will be 4 points back. And I think you got to say goodbye to LAFC and Salt Lake as well. It just feels like this is Miami's shield. Like, feels like they've done it.
If you want to crown them, then crown them. But they are who we thought they were, and we let them off the hook.
Ander, did not see that one coming.
Keep going. Oh God, Weeby, did you pick Miami to win the shield?
I think so. Again, this is a memory issue that I'm going to have to double check. If I didn't, I'm a moron.
So I did, and I'm going to take my victory lap. I will say there is a slight window of opportunity for Columbus. If Columbus is perfect the rest of the way, that includes winning their 2 games in hand, and that includes winning their head-to-head with Miami. And so if Columbus is perfect the rest of the way and Miami only drops that game against Columbus, then Miami win by 1 point. If Miami then drops any other result, then the door is still open. And look, going perfect the rest of the way is really hard.
Man, we're talking about impossible.
We're talking about setting a single season consecutive wins record. I think right now the single season consecutive wins record is 8. Miami or Columbus would have to do better than that to even make this a discussion. Oh, and by the way, they have a midweek in 3 weeks against Club America in Campeones Cup. So they have a lot more games to play. And even with a team that is incredibly deep and have shown the ability to compete for trophies on multiple fronts this year, it's probably too much to ask. But the door is not entirely shut because we're talking about a team as good as this Columbus Crew side.
I mean, Miami put it to bed probably at Chicago as a 4-1 win, as you might expect. What is most impressive about Miami this season to you? Like the overall big picture, when you're sitting in this position where we're just, as Anders put it, we're crowning them, so to speak, with at this point 7 games remaining. What is the most impressive singular thing about this effort from Miami?
Their depth. Because we've seen teams go out and go big before on DPs, and no one in history has gone bigger than this Miami team has. But they are getting contributions from Ian Frey, who's starting games in the midst of a push for the shield. And they're getting contributions from Federico Redondo and Diego Gomez. And no team has made better use of their U22 slots than what Miami has done with those guys. And they're getting contributions from Yannick Bright and from Leo Afonso. And you know, all due respect to FC Dallas, who got a gem in Logan Farrington, but I don't think anybody had a better draft than Miami did. And you just go down the list. Ben Hak-Krimaski is one of the best homegrowns in this league. Julian Gressel, all-time great free agent signing. Robert Taylor was going to be sold at the start of the year, and now he's there long-term, and he's scoring big goals and, you know, putting the icing on the cake like he did. And then, obviously, we started the show talking about Luis Suarez. He's playing like an MVP. The actual MVP of this team, for my money, is probably Sergio Busquets. And it's not that he's been so incredibly great. It's that he is always out there. You talk about a guy who is just an innings eater. Like, Busquets is always freaking out there. He leads that team in minutes at age 36. He's played on the back line. He's played in central midfield. It hasn't always been perfect. He's not the Sergio Busquets of 10 years ago. But he is giving this team the stability they need to find the moments in which to win. And they are now winning at a record-setting pace. Single season points per game record is 2.15. The Revs did that 4 years ago, 3 years ago, ended up on 73 points. Right now, Miami's at 2.19. They're on track to break the single season points record. And it's what I said at the start of the season on the show. I said, in order for it to be a successful season for Miami, they don't just need to win the Shield and one other trophy, preferably for them, MLS Cup, which is now their only other option, but they need to break the single season points record. That is the expectation that comes with having Messi, Suarez, Busquets, and Alba. Right now, it looks like they're going to do it.
Tata Martino had this to say: "The reality of having these players creates a clear obligation for us to win." As he reflected on the differences between perception between teams in MLS, quote: "I have never seen a team in MLS that had this pressure. This year, since the beginning of the season, Inter Miami is considered a great candidate to win, and they've gone out and they've done it." To me, it's that. It's the response to the pressure they have, and it shouldn't really surprise us given the pedigree of the players that they have, not just in terms of talent, but in terms of consistency of winning. And you can sit around and point at all the players that Barcelona had over the years and XYZ. There are a lot of great teams with great players. But I do think that there is an element. You know, I think Busquets is probably your best example on this team, and Suarez is right there as well, of just like what it means to really understand and appreciate that pressure, to welcome it, and then to deliver on it. And the beautiful thing is, it's not, as you said, it's not just those guys that are doing it for him. It's how clearly that has spread, how contagious that sort of expectation has been, and not just expectation, but delivering on it. Two guys that just walked into a locker room or just walked into their professional career. Like, to have those guys pick it up, understand it, deliver on it week to week, even without the GOAT, Leo Messi, for more than 1,035 minutes this season, that's what's so impressive to me. And it's not just this squad. It's not just Tata. It's, you know, it's the totality of the project and the ambition from top to bottom, whether it's like what they're building in sense of a stadium and the future that they want. But even more so, I think, in terms of the present and the team that they put together. Chris Henderson, I don't think he gets enough credit for what he's done, for filling in the little cracks, for going and getting the guy that fits into the supplemental roster, for putting Tots in a position where he can look up and down his team and say, I can play 28 players on a team with Suarez and Messi and Alba and Busquets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and still get this done. For finding a way to fit a guy like Matty Rojas into the team. For holding on to Diego Gomez somehow, some way, for when they had issues with injuries, of which they've had so freaking many. And every single time it was like, all right, well, here's the roster mechanism that we're going to trigger in order to go get this other player. And instead of it being a wild goose chase of like, can we get somebody? Is it going to be a disappointment? They're like, no, we are. It's going to be Rojas. It's going to be David Martinez. It's going to be Redondo, who comes in and fills for Facundo Farias. It's going to be top level players that continue the drive for us to win everything. And now there have been disappointments. You know, CCC was a disappointment.
I thought we were calling it CONCACAF Champions.
CONCACAF Champions is a disappointing memory.
I got you, Weavy. I got you.
I think it's the beer pong.
Yeah,
I'm going to blame it on
your
beer
brain
pong.
Cells on the floor in Tahoe.
Yes, winning has a price. All right, winning has a price. But there have been disappointments, and that's why I think it's even more impressive what they've done since Messi and Suarez were gone for first Copa, but then Messi through injury is like that was pressure on them, and they've responded to it at every turn. And I think Tata will win Coach of the Year. I don't think there's any doubt about it in my mind. Would I hope that Wilfred Nancy does? Yes, and so would Tata. And this is what he had to say about that. Quote, Columbus is a team that comes from another league. They are not from MLS. They have the particularity of not having national team players, but making a difference as if they had big stars. And that is a credit to the coach, Martino said recently.
He also said at this point, I would already give the Coach of the Year award to the Columbus coach. I wouldn't even wait until the end of the season.
Respect. Respect, yeah. Tata, but I, look, his campaign is probably going to fall short. He's probably going to get it. I can't really argue with it, even though Wilfred Nancy would be my choice. But if they set a points record and they do it in this fashion, man, will it be the best season in MLS history, regular season? Would you say that just based on the points, or would there be some other reason to discount it?
No, it probably would be, because it's not just the points. It's the fact that they've done it with their best player being injured or absent for international duty for, at this point, most of the season. And none of the other, when the Red Bulls set the record for the first time in 2018. Well, first of all, Toronto set the record or broke the record in 2017. Jovinko and Bradley and Josie were mostly healthy that season. 2018, the Red Bulls broke the record, and Brad was healthy that season. Tyler Adams was healthy that season. 2019, LAFC broke it, and Vela had the best single MLS season of all time. He was healthy and available almost the entire year. And same with the Revs in 21. Carlos Heel was awesome, and he played 3,000 minutes. And Messi is the best player that's ever played the game. He's obviously the best player still on this Miami team, and he's been on the field 1,200 minutes. And at no point has Miami slowed down. And that's a credit to the players. It's a credit to Chris Henderson, as you said. It's a credit to Tata. Oh, yeah. I don't think the Tata that we saw six, 7 years ago in Atlanta would have been as willing to go down the roster to find answers. We're seeing in this Miami group is the kind of culture where young players can get out and onto the field and into the 11 and make mistakes and not crumble because of it. When we see other teams, great teams who, like think about Bruce Arena's Galaxy teams. Like, he did a great job with those teams. Young players did not get into those lineups. When they did, if they made a mistake, that was it. They crumbled. It's a knock on Bruce. It's one of the few based upon his MLS accomplishments. What we're seeing in Miami is the opposite of that. Leo Alfonso makes a mistake, and he gets an earful from Suarez or Messi. He's making a better run the next time, and he's adding value the next game. And that... Once you create a self-sustaining culture like that, where the veterans are not just propping up, but are passing on knowledge to the younger players, first of all, you're going to win a lot of games, and it's going to be sustainable. Second of all, you're going to make a lot of money in the transfer market.
The development within the team has been incredible. And look, there you have these just like generational accelerators of that talent, right? Like, that's what these stars are when you bring them in. They give you that environment. They help set that culture and that tone. And they just play at a super high level. Just because I was curious as you were talking about that, Doyle, in terms of the depth of this roster and Tata's ability to not just trust, but get the best out of young players. I just went back and looked at 2018 Atlanta United. How many players on that team do you think played more than 520 minutes that season, the regular season?
Oh, she's 15, 18?
This is, you cheated. It's 15.
Yeah,
I don't, that. This is Rain Man stuff. This was supposed to be hard. What the heck? But to you, does that indicate What does that indicate? I mean, an expansion team is one thing. So you have less time to sort of accumulate assets and also players. Is that more indicative of MLS's growth as a league or just strictly the job that Miami have done?
I think it's both. And I think it's also, look, that Atlanta team had unusually good luck with their health that year. It's worth remembering that. Yeah, and I mean, Miami
Joseph played 2,900. Gressel played 2,900. Guzan, Larenowitz, Parkhurst, LGP, Almirón, all those guys played basically every single game.
Yeah, and Miami haven't had that kind of luck, but Atlanta would have fallen apart because MLS teams didn't have the player acquisition tools in 2018 that they do in 2024, where you can lose a Farias and go out and get a Redondo, and where you can get contributions from guys like Kromoski and Frey and Noah Allen from and David Ruiz from the academy. And then, you know, adding in Yannick Bright and Leo Afonso is the cherry on top of, well, I'm not going to tease the metaphor out any more than that. It's just a perfectly constructed roster in almost every way. And they're reaping the rewards, and everybody involved deserves a ton of credit for it.
And look, the groan I'm hearing, you know, imagining, but I'm sure it's happening right now from folks is like, hey, hold on. Luis Suarez is on a TAM deal. Hey, hold on. Jordi Alba is on a TAM deal.
Yeah, so it's Marco Royce.
Yes, good point. But also, you know, to Miami's credit, one, you're Miami, so I get it. You're going to attract different players. But two, how much time, how much effort, how much work, how much money went into attracting the man that helps attract those guys in Lionel Messi? Like, you know, work reaps rewards. And that work, those years, that money put into attracting Lionel Messi is now in part what's helped you get his buddies to help get you to this spot. All right. Any other thoughts on the Shield race? Like deeper thoughts here? We had RSL come back this weekend and drop a good result. Obviously, LAFC lost. Columbus did win, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. They knocked off New York City. Cincinnati, as we said, with Luca Rosciano won, but it seems like maybe too little too late for them. And LA lost in St. Louis. So, you know, if other teams wanted to keep the pressure up, if they wanted to do their part here for this greatest Shield race of all time, well, they're not.
Yep. No, I mean, that's it. That's it. That's a story.
Okay. Last one on this, and it's just a thing that's been percolating in my mind. Who should rep MLS at the Club World Cup has been a question that's been bouncing around for a little while here. And Commissioner Don Garber had some comments at the All-Star game about suggestions they had made to FIFA. Right now it's TBD, but it will be a host team. So Garber had said there's a lot of options. Is the MLS Cup winner? Is it the Supporters Shield winner? Is there a game between the Shield winner and the MLS Cup winner? How do you think that should be determined? And can I just say out loud that I hope that there's no team that gets in other than Miami or the Crew. Like, I hope it's one of those two teams. And I think it's hard to argue against that as a neutral.
I agree with you, though. If LAFC beat Miami or the Crew in MLS Cup or Houston, or like there's always going to be an argument for the MLS Cup winner. There just is.
Is that what you would give? Would you say MLS Cup is the one? It's what gives you the star. It's the championship. I know I'm backing you into a corner, Mr. Shield Truther, but
look, man, just because I love the way the Crew play, I'm ready to give it to the League Cup champion just to make sure that it's the Crew.
The biggest tournament in North America, obviously.
I like the idea of, you know, if Miami win the Shield and then the Crew win Cup, and then, you know, we found out on December 8th that MLS and Apple TV have scheduled a game between those two teams for the following weekend to determine who plays at in the Club World Cup. I'm not going to cry tears. I'll enjoy watching one more game between those two teams. I just think the Crew are, as much praise as we just poured on Miami, I just hope that it's actually the Crew who get in there, because I just think they're a better team right now.
How about this? Given the prestige of Leagues Cup, what if it was the 2023 and 2024 champions and the Seattle Sounders sadly get booted? No, I'm just sorry. Sorry, Anders. That was me just trolling you from afar. We'll see what happens with that, but it will be interesting. All right, Miami looks like they're going to win the Shield. We'll see if somebody can challenge them. Right now, the battles abound for playoff spots. I'm calling these playoff spots, not postseason spots. We'll talk about the bubble and the postseason spots, because I don't really count them. The battle for the four seeds. Let's dig in here. In the Western Conference, it is really, really tight. It's super thick. Right now, the Colorado Rapids are in that position, but chasing them just a few points back of the Rapids. Vancouver Whitecaps, who won in Austin this weekend, they're 3 points back. Portland, who won against Seattle at home, they're 4 points back. And the Houston Dynamo are also 4 points back. Vancouver have two games in hand on Colorado, and the Houston Dynamo have one game in hand on the Rapids. Handicap this race for me. Who are you taking and why?
Well, I like that you omitted the Sounders, who are also 4 points back. I assume that was done to spite Anders, and I respect that. Look,
who? The what?
My heart says Houston because I've already talked about how much I love watching them play and how impressed I am with what they've done to upgrade the roster and be the team that I think once we get to the playoffs, whatever the standings are of this group, Houston would be the one that I would expect to make the longest run. But Colorado have gotten themselves a little bit of a cushion. And they showed with that win in Dallas, that's a good win, that there is no sign of them having the type of post Leagues Cup hangover that kind of killed both Nashville and Inter Miami last year. And, they're starting to figure things out with Moise Bombito gone. I think Alalis Abubakar has been pretty decent over the past month, and that's huge for them. They have multiple match winners in Rafa Navarro and Georgi Mihailovic and Cole Bassett, and they can still hurt teams both on the break and on set pieces. I don't think that Colorado is going to give this up. I think if they were going to, it would have started happening this past weekend when they had every opportunity to lose that game and figured out a way to instead take 3 points.
I just want to say I'm very disappointed in you that you didn't mention Darren Yappe in your game changers / game winners list, as he did in fact win that game. My sons a couple, I don't know, those big boxes of cards. They love soccer cards. It's so much fun for me to open them with them because they're like, who's this guy? And then I feel like, you know, my job is to talk about these players and to have this depth of knowledge on these players. And I'm trying to explain to a 4 and a 6-year-old who just love this little piece of cardboard who this guy is and to tell a story to them about Darren Yappe. And I was happy that we pulled that card last night in our first pack opening. I'm with you on the Rapids. I hope that they get it done just because the story is so good. And there's still, I think, a lot of room for them to grow, not just this season, but in transfer windows in the future. You mentioned the Seattle Sounders, and I just want to throw out what I think is just an absolutely incredible scheduling quirk. Their last four games, the Sounders, home against Houston, at Vancouver, at Colorado, final day of the season, decision day, home against Portland. All four teams currently ahead of them as they battle for that four seed. Three games prior, at Columbus, that one's tough. That's coming up this weekend. Massive game on Apple TV. Sporting Kansas City at home, San Jose at home. So the Sounders have every opportunity to set themselves up, you would think, with 6 points out of nine. But hey, look, we could be surprised because I think Cucho's gone with Columbia, etc. To set themselves up to chase that four seed with abandon and to do it against their direct head-to-head rivals. So as Anders says in the chat right now, quote, oh, we coming for that four spot. We're back. I'm convinced. He says 9 out of 9 points, but I'm not going to give him that one. I'm going to take, just for funsies, not because they have the track record to do it, not because they've proved that in moments of true pressure that they stand up and can be counted. Let me make the case for the Vancouver Whitecaps for you. They're probably in the best overall form as far as just points, with 9 points from 12 in their last couple games. That Houston loss at home is looking pretty painful, but they have the most games in hand and they have home games. Dallas, San Jose, both at home, at Houston, so that's a direct rivalry there, and Houston haven't been great at home. At LA, Portland, Seattle, Minnesota at home, LAFC at home, at RSL to end the season. It is not easy. These are mostly playoff teams. But this is the sort of stretch that Vancouver, with a new designated player in Stuart Armstrong, where they have to be counted, Doyle. Where it's like, hey, what kind of club are you? Are you a club that's happy to be sixth or seventh and just sort of sneak in and probably get knocked out in the playoffs because you don't have home field advantage? Or are you a club that's actually going to change the narrative around you and handle business down the stretch and go into the playoffs as a favorite and have to deliver on that moniker. Like, I think there's a decent chance the Vancouver Whitecaps can actually get it done. You don't.
I mean,
drawn breath told me that you don't. And I understand.
I'm not expecting it. Same. They did sign a new DP, you know, and they have upgraded that central midfield with Stuart Armstrong. You know, the hope is that Brian White will not be hurt. He you know, missed the game with concussion protocol, I believe. Yes. If he's not back, I'm not expecting them to win many more games this year.
I agree. Can I just add something? Why is Simon Betcher not on this team?
Yeah.
Why was he sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars to Denmark?
Yeah,
he wanted to go? But given his production and sort of given the holes in their roster at that position, I guess they have Demir Krylock, but wouldn't you rather have long-term Simon Betcher? I remain confused, but...
I think the way they looked at it was they were going to get $500,000 for a late first-round draft pick, and that was, like, you can't... I could understand why teams would not want to turn that down, though.
But in retrospect, what can $500,000 get you? It can't get you Simon Betcher.
Yeah. No, at this point, Simon Betcher is a starter for St. Louis. There have been some questionable decisions in terms of this roster build. There are some concerns I have about the lack of development from young players. Like, their one real success with that in recent years was Javane Brown, and they just cut him. And now he's starting for a team above them in the standings, at least this past week he did. It's weird. I think they're a good team. I just don't. And they look, if Colorado drop off, there's definitely a path for Vancouver to climb above them and take that fourth spot. I wouldn't expect them to win a playoff series against any of these teams in the hunt. Like, if they face Portland in the 4-5, Seattle, Houston, or Colorado, even though Vancouver have two games at home, I would not expect them to win that series.
Yeah, Vancouver have been better on the road than at home, which is a surprising thing for a club that has often really struggled away from BC Place. Well, let's talk about Stuart Armstrong real quick and what we think he might bring to this team. If you look at just the numbers, you go to FBref, you scroll through the comps, you look at the overall production from him at Southampton and Celtic before that, it's really good. He's 32 years old. He signed a DP deal through 2026. Obviously, Vancouver did not pay a fee on this one. He was a free agent. I'll throw it out there. I don't know what this means. Comps on FBref for the last 365 days. There's three MLS players in there: Ricky Pouge, Marcel Hartl, and Robin Ludd. That might mean something. It might mean nothing, but it's pretty good. As far as attacking production, he's darn high against comparable midfielders in his competitions over the last 365 days. As far as defensive ones, it's very low. So it feels like, to me, Pedro Vite probably ain't going to play a ton.
Yep.
What do you think a player with that profile, we don't know how he's going to fit, adds to this team?
I mean, the answer is elite chance creation, and that's something that they have absolutely needed. Ryan Gold does a lot of that, but I think they're actually better in when they play with a two up top, when Gold is a second forward running off of a 10 and off of Brian White. I thought that this was going to be the year that Vite became that number 10, but he's actually, I think, regressed. He had pretty easily his best moment of the season this past weekend. I think Armstrong just comes in and takes that spot. He'll play it a little deeper, but that's fine. And then I think that you reconstitute the midfield a little bit more. Like, everything that Sartini has done this year has been a lot of rotations in terms of they start in a 3-2-4-1, but then they sort of rotate into a 3-3-3-1 when they're on the ball, and Gold goes from a pressing second forward to a number 10, and the wing backs pinch in to become wing. It's a lot. Everything about Vancouver is a lot. I think this has a chance to simplify it. And you sort of funnel the ball through Stuart Armstrong to unlock defenses, and you let one wing back stay a real wingback, and then you make the other Fafa Picot, who's been a reliable third goal scorer this year. So you have essentially a three-man goal-scoring troop of Picot, White, and Gold, but then and Gold will do a lot of the primary chance creation, but Stuart Armstrong does a lot of the ball progression and secondary chance creation as well. In my head, that's how it works. In my head, and in Vanni Sartini's head,
I was just going to say,
often very different things, unless we're talking about Gramsci and Italian socialism of the 1930s. Then we're kind of simpatico. But in terms of soccer, it's tough. He's kind of a madman.
It's really sick to me to be in this position to see two Scotland internationals on the same team in Gold and Armstrong, and think back to 2012 when Kenny Miller and Barry Robson both ran around on that field as Scottish DPs. What a moment! What a callback that is for Vancouver, and a big win on the road for them. They are the they've got 7 wins away this season. That's pretty good. They got to figure out BC place. Austin took the L in this one. Any quick thoughts on Austin? I don't think we're going to talk about him in the bubble in the West, really.
No, I mean, they still have a shot, but they've moved, you know, Josh Wilson has moved Sebastian Driussi to a false nine over the past, I think, 3 or 4 games. They don't get enough of the ball to make it work. Like, when you're playing with a false nine, you're kind of saying, we want to be a team that has the ball and uses it in unusual ways to disorganize teams before we even get to the final third. And they haven't shown the ability to do that. They're dead last in shots per game generated off of a passing sequence. They generate just 9 shots per game off of passing sequences, which is actually 20% worse than the 28th place team. There's a bigger gap between 29 and 28 than there is between 28 and 14. And then, you know, Drewsy is trying, and you can see it defensively, his commitment for a guy who wears a number 10 and makes the amount of money that he does. Defensively, his commitment is A+. Well, the guys around him, not sure whether it's a commitment level or just confusion as to their pressing cues, because there were some obvious anger between Drewsy and the other guys, notably Osman Bakari. Drewsy was pretty upset with him. This doesn't look like a team that's going anywhere. It just doesn't. They just don't have any attacking juice, and the defense isn't quite good enough. It feels like it's all headed for a teardown to me.
I mean, if it's going to teardown, if you're Driussi, you might not want to be around for that, but you probably do want to collect your $6.5 million or whatever it is a year. So I don't know if they're real or not, some rumors about Flamengo coming in for Driussi, and that would sort of make sense to me that, you know, at his stage of his career, he would want to do something like that. The question would probably be the money, both incoming for Austin and also into the pocket of Driussi. But man, if you're going to rebuild and tear down this roster and you could open up a DP spot and open up also that level of spending on salary, if you're Austin, if that's real, you probably got to listen real hard to that. All right, let's take a look at the 4 spot in the East. This is a little bit of a slap fight, Doyle. Like, in the West, I feel like those 4 teams we talked about, okay, fine, 5 with the Seattle Sounders. There's something there, right? In the East, it feels less so to me at this point in time. So sitting 1, 2, 3, Miami, Cincinnati, Columbus, those, you know, done and dusted. Those are going to be top seeds in the East. Then it's the Red Bulls on 42 points, currently in 4th. New York City, 3 points behind. Charlotte, 4 points behind, and they're pretty listless right now. And then Orlando on 37 points. Who you taking?
I feel like NYCFC of this group are playing the best ball, and I like their group the most in terms of the amount of talent they have, and I like the way they play. They have 1 win in their last 11 games.
I was going to say that in the last 6, it's 2 losses and 4 draws, and those draws, 2 were against the Chicago Fire, 1 is against Atlanta United.
Yeah, in their last 11 across all competitions, they only have 1 win. Granted, it was against Tigres. And I feel like they've played Columbus really tough twice. So there's some life there. And if they go on the road next weekend, and beat DC United, then they, I mean, it's still a really tough schedule for the most part until the last couple of games. But I like the way that they're playing. And it's not like the Red Bulls or Charlotte are making any, you know, compelling case for themselves. For Charlotte, it's one win in their last nine.
What happened here? Like, Charlotte was one of the darling stories of the season, and I still see some sparkle to them. And their transfer window was in equal parts ambitious and disappointing. But, man, it's like...
We see it every year.
It's like that. They can't take the next step. Just can't take that next step from, like, defensively solid, but not chance creation menaces in any way. And now the opportunism seems to just kind of have left them in terms of goal scoring.
To their credit, they know that they need to take that next step, that they need to be a team that can use the ball a little bit and not just be a purely against the ball thing. But as they've gotten more expansive or tried to get more expansive, they've become more vulnerable. And they're still no good at all at creating chances outside of counterattacks. And what we see every year is teams that are sort of punching above their weight by midseason by just playing on the counter, which is what Charlotte were. We see them sort of fade down the stretch, because at this point in the season, most teams have gotten good enough with the ball to punish low block teams. Charlotte are still largely a low block team. They need Pep Biel to be very good. If he's not, then they're kind of a one-trick pony heading into the postseason, which they'll make, but I don't think they'd be favored against anybody.
If you're looking at just, look, you're going to go look at XG, non-penalty XG, shot creating actions, all that. Charlotte are not just in the bottom half. They're in like the bottom five or six of MLS. And I think this is where they hope that like Karol Swiderski would come in and just be a more efficient finisher than Pat Adjiman. But it feels to me like, given the recent history and given the way they play and their struggles to create chances in the ways we're talking about, it feels to me like, despite his sometimes lack of composure or, I don't know, little bit of sort of technical quality sometimes, it feels like it might be time to go back to Pat Adjiman. Like, who's the future of this team? I'm not saying forever in Ajimon's case, because I'm sure that even if Swiderski leaves, they're going to want to sign a DP9. But who is more likely medium long term to impact this club? I think it's Adjiman, and it's a bummer for Charlotte that in Karol Swiderski's case, he didn't improve his value and get moved on when he went on loan to Italy, and he has come back into a better team and hasn't really got it done this time.
He has not been as good as Adjiman this year. I medium, long, whatever you want. If you want to win a game tomorrow and you're Charlotte, I think you start Adjiman over Swiderski.
I'm going to take the Red Bulls, and I'm not proud of it. I'm not happy about it. It's just because, like I said, it is a bit of a slap fight, and they have that 3-point lead, and their schedule the rest of the way is very, very convincing. Now, they will find a way in a schedule where they are home against Kansas City, at Chicago, home against Atlanta and New York City, at Toronto, at Atlanta, and then finish off. And they would hope that they don't need anything out of this game, home against Columbus. If they can't get it done there, what are we even doing? What are we doing, Red Bulls? What?
Two wins in 13 for the Red Bulls.
I know.
Two wins in spring. Two wins in 3 months.
But it might just take draws to get that fourth spot in the East.
It might. And
if you need draws, the Red Bulls will get you draws.
Orlando are 5 points behind the Red Bulls.
I would take Orlando in a second if that gap was three or less. And they might still do it. They might still do it. I don't know. I remain so disappointed by the same thing I've said over and over, by the lack of ambition for the New York Red Bulls, who are sitting in fourth place by the skin of their teeth. And if anybody else could actually get their ish together, they wouldn't be there and seem to be pretty satisfied. I don't know how much we'll see Emil Forsberg the rest of this season. I don't think we'll see him until after the international break. And even then, dude's been on the shelf for how long? He can't just walk back in and play 90 minutes. Like, the best case scenario is to have him ready and able to do that around playoff time. And by then, I still just think that the flaws within the team are too big. Like, they need to be able, the only guy on this team who can create his own shot and is a reliable goal scorer is Lewis Morgan. And because Forsberg is gone, they have to play him at the 10. So because they did not go out and get the job done in the transfer window, and because Forsberg can't stay on the field, their best player has to play out of position and their weaknesses get magnified.
Looking at this Orlando schedule, they have two very tough games. They have at Columbus and at Cincinnati. Everything else, home against New England, home against Charlotte, at Dallas, which is not easy, but it's winnable. Home against Philadelphia, that'll be a battle. And then they finish up home against Atlanta. I think I just talked myself into Orlando getting fourth in the East. And they've certainly, you know, since about mid-June, they have been by far the best team in this group.
Can I just throw a yes, but in there? I'm just looking at their wins of recent, not even recent, long-term vintage. At DC, at Philly when Philly were bad in a 3-2 win, at San Jose, Chicago at home, at Toronto, DC at home, at New England, at Nashville, Nashville.
Yeah, I mean, it's not murderer's row, but they, you know, they also drew Cruz Azul in League's Cup, and Cruz Azul is crushing in Liga MX right now. And the, like, the most important thing is they're burying the teams that they should bury. And
I don't trust any of the other teams to do that around them. You're right, I don't.
Yep. That four-headed attack that they've got now, with Angulo on the left, Facu Torres, who has 6 goals and 5 assists in his last 11 games, on the right, Martino Ojeda as the number 10, and then either Ramiro Henrique or Duncan Maguire up top. Like, those are pieces that fit together. And since Ojeda moved to the number 10, I think they're 6-2-3 in their 11 games. He's got 3 goals and 5 assists. He takes the pressure to be a playmaker off Facu, and it lets Facu just ball. I think there's a stronger, even though they're 5 points back, I think there's a stronger argument for Orlando than either of us realized heading into this segment.
I agree. Here's the thing that we have to remember, and sometimes I forget it. When I think about the 4 seed, I often just think about home field advantage. Hey, you want to play 2 games at home. I'm thinking less in those scenarios, and wrongly so, about opponent. If you can get the 4 seed in both conferences, you get to avoid playing 2 or 3 games in the Eastern Conference against Miami, Cincinnati, or Columbus. You don't got to do it.
Yeah.
Or in the Western Conference, you get to avoid both LA sides, RSL. So it's not just home field advantage. It's also just avoiding the quote-unquote juggernauts, the teams that have done it, that have the better talent, that seem to be in better rhythm. It matters. It really matters. The playoff spots on the bubble, you know, we'll play those up. It'll be fun on decision day. Every point matters. Can they jump in? Can they jump out? But reality is, those teams are probably fodder for the top seed. If you can get that 4 seed, you might be able to push yourself past the first round and get yourself in a position where it's win or go home. And if you can win 1 road game, you can keep it moving. All right, let's finish off with the postseason teams, the bubble teams. I can't, in good conscience, call them playoff teams. In the West, right now, Seattle and Minnesota are your 8 and 9. But as we said, Seattle is right there on 5, 6, 7, trying to push their way up, maybe even to the top 4. And then Minnesota has been listless for a while, but fortunately for them, they're being chased by a bunch of pretenders. And then St. Louis, who just, it's too little too late in all likelihood, they're 9 points back. In the West, who could jump it? Who could and will they?
I still think that Dallas is going to get it done. This was a pretty brutal loss to the Rapids over the weekend. Like, they had, I think, 2 leads in that one, Dallas did. And like, you can't give up home points when you've been so poor on the road all season long. And now their next 2 games are at Vancouver and at RSL. And then they follow that up with home against LAFC. So it is a brutal remaining schedule for FC Dallas, but Austin's is actually more difficult. And Minnesota's is really tough too. Minnesota is at St. Louis, which is not a cakewalk at this point. Home to Cincinnati, at Kansas City, who are playing much better ball, though that is right before the Open Cup final. So it could be a rotated Kansas City team. Then they host Colorado, who we've talked about being good, at RSL, at Vancouver, and then home to St. Louis City. So there are only two teams that Minnesota are facing that are under the playoff line, are two teams in Kansas City and St. Louis that are playing much better ball than they had been the start of the year. And if you look at it over the past, I think, three or four months, the only teams that that Minnesota have beaten are Kansas City at home and San Jose twice. That's rough. It's hard to imagine.
And there's not a lot of draws mixed in there either. It's not like, oh, well, we were just, it's L's. It's a vast number of L's. I'm going to just argue that it holds steady. I don't believe in Dallas enough, even though I believe with all my heart in big dog, hot dog, Logan Farrington. So I'm going to argue that this holds steady in the West, that the way it is the way it is. Minnesota will certainly be a postseason team and not a playoff team. And then it's sort of a crapshoot between Vancouver, Portland, Houston, and Seattle as to who drops down. Do you want to give me like a solid minute on Farrington here? Just I'm gonna sit back and enjoy the analysis because this dude can play.
Like, yeah, he's just a good all around player at this point. Where you know he makes the right pass if it's there. It's not like he's visionary, but he makes decisions quickly.
Yes,
right?
He's clean too. And we noticed this like basically out the jump to start the season because they didn't immediately have Musa and he was playing a bunch of minutes and he was playing in ways that you know, look, Nico Estevez was having him sort of drop into the pocket sometimes. And that's not a very comfortable position for a guy that you would think with his, you know, with his history and his body type is more of a nine, but he was able to drop in and like receive and turn and do it like with an efficiency of touches and keep his head up and then make the right pass and then move. Like, it's not just, hey, I'm a big guy that finishes. He's a player.
He never lets a scrambled defense reset itself. He's ready to go. And I think that fits in really well with what Peter Luxon wants. And it's why he's been able to give them so many good minutes really across that entire front line. And now with Jesus Ferreira, Alan Velasco, Peter Musa back, he's probably back into much more of a supporting role, probably off the bench, but like they hit it out of the park with this draft pick. And if they sell Jesus Ferreira this offseason, I think there's a lot of obvious minutes there for Farrington to earn heading into 2025.
Right now, the rumors or reports or fill in the blanks around Jesus are that Las Palmas was in for him in this last transfer window. We'll see what happens with Jesus on that one. All right, Eastern Conference bubble, and we'll get on out of here. I'm going to go Philly in, Doyle. Mm-hmm. I believe in the Union. I believe in Ty Barabow. I believe in Mikel Ua, who has triggered his clause to get a contract for next season. Congratulations to him. And I'm booting Toronto, man. They gone. I just don't see it. I don't see it for them. They wilt in too many relatively big moments.
John Herdman doesn't see it either. He lit into his team after that 3-1 loss.
How many times has that happened this year?
Yeah. This one was, I think, an extra level from him. The Union at Miami, at NYCFC, home to DC, home to Atlanta, at Orlando, at Columbus, home to Cincinnati.
That
is freaking brutal, dude.
It is.
That is a tough. Toronto, home to Austin, home to Columbus, at Colorado, at Chicago, home to New York, home to Miami. It's an easier schedule that Atlanta have. Not easy outright, but there are more plausible points there.
Yeah, but DC at home was very plausible.
That's fair.
Nashville at home, Chicago at home, all of those are losses since the start of June.
Atlanta have Nashville at home, Miami at home, at the Red Bulls, at the Union, home to Montreal, home to the Red Bulls, at Orlando.
That's not easy either.
No, it's not. But there's some points. Like, God, you if you're an Atlanta fan, you would love to have seen them get Montreal on the schedule now because they are just giving away goals. And Atlanta need a little bit of that. They got a good win this past weekend, though.
Well, let me throw this out there, then, and you can spike it or you can say, oh, that could happen. That could be interesting because we're very much in the time of the season where we're looking at games played, we're digging into remaining schedule, and we're just trying to prognosticate. Could you make an argument that the New England Revolution, who have played the fewest games in the Eastern Conference, three less than Toronto, two less than Atlanta, they trail by not insignificantly 7 points to Toronto and 5 points to Atlanta. Is there a world in which the New England Revolution and Caleb Porter can make that epic climb and on decision day somehow, some way, find their way into, again, the postseason?
Yes. Yep. Because they do have those games in hand. And we're going to see one of them this weekend against at home for the Revs against St. Louis City. And St. Louis is a much better team right now. But I think the Revs are too, because Carlos Hill is healthy. And I think we'll see Vrioni and Barrero and maybe even Luca Longoni in the starting lineup. I like the Revs' chances. I feel like, you know, they've been really up and down. They had a good run in midsummer, but have tailed off since then. But their remaining schedule is pretty accommodating. And like, if they just take their home points, I think that'll be just about enough for them to do it. Especially because none of the teams around them are going to be running away with it.
All right, it's going to be interesting. We didn't mention DC, and DC absolutely have a chance. They're just 2 points off right now. By the way, big news for DC as well. They signed Christian Benteke to a contract extension through 2025, club option 2026. And probably the most absurd thing that we will say on this entire show, you know, argue at your own leisure here, is that Christian Benteke has won 244 aerials this season, and second place has 87. Doyle, now, it does make sense. If you're a dominant center back, just like a dominant cornerback in football, they don't throw the ball at you, or they don't kick the ball in the air at you. Whereas in Christian Benteke's case, they're kicking the ball in the air at his head as much as humanly possible. But it's still completely absurd that he's doing that, and he's tied for the Golden Boot lead, I believe, on 17 goals. All right, anything else to finish up here? Any lingering thoughts?
No, I think we're good.
Yeah, six games this weekend. Go watch them. MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Oh, and by the way, there is a report, capital R report, from Tommy Scoops, Tom Bogert out there, that Mikey Varas, currently the interim coach of the USMNT ahead of this international window, will be the head coach of San Diego next season. So, San Diego folks, if you got thoughts, we want to hear them when that goes official, or if we just have more time next week, we will dig into that as well. In the meantime, enjoy your week, everybody. This is MLS on Wednesday, on YouTube. You can go check that out if you want a little more content to lead you into six matches this weekend. With that, for Anders, for Doyle, for Maria, I'm Weeby. Adios. We'll be right back.